I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. In the middle of the Cold War, and having been shamed by the Soviet Union when it launched Sputnik into space in October 1957, President Kennedy made a bold pronouncement on September 12, 1962, speaking at Rice University.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
Although he didn't live long enough to witness it, on July 20th, 1969, Kennedy's vision came true when astronauts Neil Armstrong, followed by Buzz Aldrin, took those famous first steps on the moon. I spoke with Buzz Aldrin 20 years ago about what it was like to be part of history.
When we came back, we were showed some television of the response of the public, the world, to the moment when we landed, just as a reminder, because we didn't see that. See, we were out of town.
Oh, yes, you were.
And I tapped Neil on the shoulder and I said, look, we missed the whole thing. And, you know, we were it, but we missed the major impact, which was the impact of a successful landing on very interested people back here worldwide, and the value that it put in their lives so that they remember where they were.
Well, today in Radio Times, we mark the 50th anniversary of the moon landing to talk about what it took to get the Apollo 11 mission literally off the ground to the moon and back, and where space travel is going today, including the Artemis mission to put astronauts on the moon by 2024. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Jacob Bleacher. He's a planetary geologist and chief exploration scientist in NASA's Advanced Exploration Systems Division. That's within the Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate at NASA. That's a bit of a mouthful, Jacob Bleacher. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, and thanks for having me. This is a very exciting time, so I'm happy to share that excitement with all your listeners.
Absolutely, and also here to share some of the excitement is Derek Pitts. He's chief astronomer and planetarium director at the Franklin Institute here in Philadelphia, also a NASA Solar System Ambassador. Derek Pitts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times
as
well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Much to discuss. And Jake, let me begin with you. You are on the Mall. This is obviously a very important anniversary. What does it mean to you today?
This is just, it's so exciting right now. You know, we are celebrating the first steps on the lunar surface. We are celebrating the launch a couple days ago. Saturday, we're celebrating the landing, and next week, the recovery by the USS Hornet. Those are tremendous steps forward for exploration and for humankind. At the same time, we're looking forward at an exciting opportunity to send humans back to the moon. We're anticipating sending the first woman and next man to the South Pole of the moon with the Artemis program. So this is just an exciting time. It's really hard to capture it in words.
I want to pick up on the Artemis program. Derek, let me get, you were 14 years old in 1969.
Yes.
Where were you? The cliched question of the day.
Of course, my brother and I were in our mother's bedroom that evening watching all of this unfold on television. Of course, it was late in the evening, 10:30, and it was, of course, dark outside, and we had the lights off in the room to increase the contrast of the view so that we could get the best view we could. For me, this was the most exciting thing that had ever happened in my young life at that point, and I'd been following the space program for quite some time and recognized this as the culmination of all of the work that had gone before in the Mercury and the Gemini programs.
So your career was launched essentially watching this moon landing?
This was incredibly formative for me in the determination of where I wanted to end up, the kind of work I wanted to end up doing, and I couldn't think of anything better to do. It was exciting and encouraging and just propelled me in this direction.
We were listening to President Kennedy with those, frankly, very inspiring words about going to the moon. But, Derek, you and I were chatting off the air, basically, that Kennedy was not a big enthusiast of the space program.
No, he wasn't actually a big enthusiast. This was an idea that was brought to him as something that could be done. But he really was trying to do something much more important, he felt, and that was to beat the Russians to the conquest of space. He wanted America to have superiority over the space environment for military purposes, really, and to show the world that if you are going to follow a country, I mean, this is at the point where we have these two great superpowers that are vying for the connection to all the other countries around the world, and Kennedy really wanted to put the United States out there as the country that the other countries around the world wanted to follow and support to become part of. So for him, it was that piece, but it was also another political piece of having something in his young presidency that he could use to rally everybody in the United States around that would help to support his position. But he wasn't really a big space enthusiast.
Yeah, and yet here we are. Jacob, let me go back to you. And even thinking about the Artemis mission to put astronauts back on the moon by the year 2024, and it is fascinating to read about just how risky this was 50 years ago and what could have gone wrong. There's talk about the sort of daisy chain of effects that everything had to essentially work pretty much perfectly in order to get these astronauts onto the moon and then back. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, you know, Derek made the comment about that success being built on all the hard work of prior missions and the engineers and scientists that were working on it. And Artemis is no different. Any exploration carries risk with it. But that risk is important to tackle that risk. That's how you find and discover new things, whether it's the deep ocean or harsh environments here on the Earth or the even harsher environments of deep space. Just as a species, humankind has always tackled those risks. And so that's what we're doing now. And we're moving forward onto the moon. And we learned a tremendous amount from those missions in Apollo. And we have no confusion about the fact that we're riding on the shoulders of our predecessors who did that in Apollo. We learned those lessons, and now we're looking at going back to the moon and in the process learning about how to survive in deep space, potentially staying for longer periods of time at the moon, and then eventually understanding how we survive in deep space so we can move on to other places like Mars.
Well, let me ask you a very practical question. Do you think this can be done by the year 2024 to get astronauts back on the moon?
We're doing what we need to do to get there by 2024. We have plans in place. We'll be working with commercial partners. We're engaging our international partners as well. The goal is there, and we're ready to achieve it.
What do you think about this Artemis mission, Derek?
I think it's tremendously exciting. It's about time we really put together a program that could actually work, that does build on the work that's gone before to take astronauts back to the moon. It's imperative for us in our consideration of doing deep solar system exploration that we set up the moon as a jumping off point, really, to accomplish that work. It's expensive sending stuff into space, so if we can have an off-Earth station that we can use to build up not just our skills, but to have a place where we can develop the infrastructure necessary to do the deep space exploration, that's going to be a great step forward for us.
How important is it to have people in space for the rest of us on Earth?
Well, you know, that's a really great question, because one can certainly argue that space exploration so far, NASA has done a tremendous job of sending probes to every planet of the solar system, robotic missions that have done a great job. But, you know, humans are curious. We are exploratory. We want to know. And there are certain kinds of operations that indeed do take a human on the spot to be able to integrate all of the information that's being presented and to come to some sort of a conclusion. And so I think we will always be explorers. We'll always be out there, whether it's a government agency that's doing it. People will always want to go. I don't think we'll be able to stop that.
Well, Jake, I'm curious about more about this Artemis mission, and it is to land astronauts on the South Pole of the moon. Why the South Pole?
Yeah, the South Pole is a very intriguing location on the moon. The Apollo missions landed near the equator on the side of the moon that faces the Earth. So this is really a new destination for us. But there are some unique aspects to it that really drive us to that location. One, there are places on the lunar South Pole that we believe see the sun for 80% of the time. And so that, for us, is a major resource. That is an ability for us to provide power to our systems. It also helps us to control the thermal conditions that we'll be dealing with. So nighttime on the moon is very cold. And so designing your systems to be able to tolerate 50% light and 50% dark is tough. So if we can find some locations where we can tap into that longevity of exposure to sunlight, that will be really helpful to us. That's a really key resource. Furthermore, and this really ties into the science, is there are locations at the polar region. The sun doesn't get very high above the horizon. So there are depressions or locations behind large rocks or ridges that we think are permanently in shadow, don't see sunlight. And what that means is that there may be locations where water ice could potentially be preserved. Now, that's really exciting for two reasons. The ice could be used as another resource for us. We could mine the water. Water's really heavy. Everything that you bring with you comes at a cost.
Right.
If we can use the resources there, that's great. The other aspect is that water is probably delivered to the moon, at least some of it, by comets and other effects from the evolution of the solar system. And so this location on the moon, it really probably provides us with an opportunity to collect samples and make measurements that will help us unravel the history of the solar system.
Fascinating. And there is a kind of a small space station, Jake, that's going to be operational, where astronauts, I guess, can come and go to the moon and back?
So you're talking about the Gateway. So the
yes.
Artemis program includes two key elements, I would say, the Gateway and the landing system. So the Gateway will be in orbit around the moon, in an orbit that takes it as far away as 70,000 kilometers away from the moon, so truly out into deep space. And you could probably compare the Gateway to the Apollo command module. In Apollo, they didn't just launch straight from the Earth and land on the moon. They launched from the Earth and went into orbit around the moon, and one astronaut stayed in the command module in orbit, and two astronauts went to the surface on the lunar module. So the Gateway is kind of like our command module. So the landing system will go to the Gateway, will be launched to the Gateway without humans in it, and it will rendezvous with the Gateway. The humans, the astronauts, will come later on an Orion spacecraft.
Wow.
They'll use the Gateway to kind of keep the systems going and keep them safe, and then they will ride with the Human Landing System, or HLS, to low lunar orbit and then descend to the lunar surface. So together, the Gateway, again, which is kind of like our command module from Apollo, and then the landing system, which is like our lunar module from Apollo.
That's very cool. And we have to say goodbye to you, Jacob Leecher. Thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times and telling us a bit more about the Artemis mission.
Yep. Thanks for having me, and enjoy the excitement. It's going to be a great weekend.
Absolutely. And he's a planetary geologist, chief exploration scientist in NASA's Advanced Exploration Systems. Derek Pitt staying with us for the rest of the hour, chief astronomer, planetarium director at the Franklin Institute, also a NASA solar system ambassador. We are talking about what happened 50 years ago tomorrow. And you can join us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email with your memories, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. You probably know this by now. 50 years ago tomorrow, Apollo 11 that was orbiting the moon sent the Eagle spacecraft down to the lunar surface with astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on board. Well, there was intense competition to design the spacesuits for the Apollo 11, and a firm in Dover, Delaware, International Latex Corporation, that made the Playtex Living girdle and bra, beat out their rivals. The suits had to keep the astronauts safe and allow them to move and be flexible. No easy task. Our guest, Bill Airy, former manager of the Quality Test Lab at ILC Dover, responsible for testing the spacesuits, is working on a book titled Lunar Outfitters, and he joins us on Radio Times. Bill Airy, nice to have you with us on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I should say, Derek Pitts knows you very well, he was telling me.
Hi, Bill.
Yes, yes. It's been a few years, but we've had a good correspondence, and he's been down visiting our plant before, and I've always enjoyed working with him.
Fair enough. Well, help us, Bill, understand then about what the requirements were, and I guess we should go back to the 1960s, and I know your company was making spacesuits for the military, so you weren't wasn't just bras and girdles, I guess I'm trying to say here. But what were the requirements?
Well, you know, we started designing a spacesuit. We had an engineer by the name of Len Shepard back in the mid-50s. He saw a need for what would be truly the first true spacesuits because at the time, other companies such as David Clark and B.F. Goodrich were building high-altitude suits for the military. And Len Shepard really saw a need for the first true spacesuits, and he went to the Air Force with it because in the 50s, he thought that and many others probably thought that the first humans to launch into space might be on board an Air Force rocket of some sort. And so he saw that there were no true spacesuits, so he set out to do this, and not really knowing what the requirements were, other than good mobility, pressurization. You had that pressurization, but no one was out there with setting out requirements of what it would be until Kennedy announced we were going to get to the moon by the end of the decade. And by then, I'm really jumping ahead in the story because there's a lot to it. That's why I put the book together. But by the early 60s, NASA started formulating what the requirements would be if we were truly to get to the moon by the end of the decade. And it included things such as protection from meteorites traveling at very high velocities, radiation, temperature extremes, the pressurization you had to have. So there were a lot of variables. And so we weren't a real true aerospace company. We were a division of Playtex. Our engineers didn't come from designing bras and girdles, as some people like to say.
It's such a good story, though, don't you think?
No, it is. It is, and I certainly understand why people want to make that connection. And in fact, really, some of our seamstresses did come from that side. So they were making some bras and girdles and doing some development work over on that side, and we needed really good seamstresses to put these suits together. So they came over and joined us. But again, we weren't an aerospace company, so we were up against some stiff competition. And NASA looked at us as good inventors and good designers, but they really questioned whether or not we'd be able to get that suit together and in a production setting and meet all the requirements. And
you did.
Yeah. Long story short, again, it worked, and we got to the moon with that suit.
Derek, let me get you back in on the conversation. And Bill, I've got a couple more questions for you as well. And just, now that we know what it at least looked like from Earth when Armstrong and Aldrin were on the moon and things like, a torn suit if anything had gone wrong with that suit, these guys
in very deep trouble, sure, right. And so it was very important that the suits could do everything as Bill described. And they really are an amazing piece of technology in themselves, in that they do all of those things and more. The exterior material that the suits were made of was incredibly resistant to puncture. And then there was this ingenious layer. I love it. So a rubber layer, a thinner rubber layer on the interior that would be used to absorb the energy of any of the micrometeoroids that would have passed through the exterior, which was really almost bulletproof in itself. And so in that, with all the other energy layers and the radiation layers, it was as if the astronauts were in their own spaceship, their individual spaceship, along with the life support systems and everything else. It's a remarkable piece of equipment. But I also understand that some of the materials, and I hope Bill might mention a little bit about this, that the materials, although they were perfect for this job, were not meant to play together for a very long time.
Oh, interesting.
So they had a limited shelf life, as it were.
Bill, can you speak to that? No, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. The suits were made up of rubber, as Derek said, and I've done some work. I've over the last, it's been 18, 19 years now with the Smithsonian. I've worked with them on the preservation of their suits, and particularly of interest to me was the Neil Armstrong suit. And I've handled his suit, and actually one time when I was moving it around, I actually tipped the arm over, and black dust particles were coming out of the arm, and it was the rubber that had broken down in the suit, because, this suit was, the rubber rubber in it, it had a shelf life. When we designed these suits and built them, they were good for at least a year toward the end of the program. In the beginning part of the year, we thought, our beginning part of the program, we thought it'd be good for at least a year. But by Apollo 14, we had some suits we had to bring back to our plant and take them apart, literally dissect those suits and put new rubber in them because the rubber was decaying in the suit that quickly. So there was a lot of nervous tension going on at that time because we had to meet these launch schedules and we were working around the clock. So we learned the hard way. We finally got in some rubber experts and figured out some additive to put in the rubber to make it last longer. And so those suits in the Smithsonian after Apollo 14 are just as good as the day they were made. But rubber wasn't the way to go today. It was then. It was state of the art. In terms of other materials, the outer layers of the suit, the beta cloth on the outside was fire resistant up to about 1,200 degrees, and that came about after the Apollo 1 fire, which took the lives of the three Apollo 1
astronauts. In 67, right.
And we were scrambling at that point. Our engineers thought we had it locked in. We had a design going, and lo and behold, the fire happens, and all the boards, the NASA boards, start meeting and determine that we had to think of another way of protecting the astronauts. And when it came down to the suit, we had to go. We turned to Owens Corning to develop materials. They already had the material out there. And I would add that, you know, a lot of these materials came from Delaware. They were DuPont materials, most of them. The outer layer the beta cloth was Owens Corning, but it would withstand those 1,200 degree temperatures. It was a woven fiberglass and. So those are the challenges we were constantly under. I mean, we'd test the suits in the labs. They would fail, which is where you want them to fail. You don't want them to fail 240,000 miles away. And as Derek said, these are their spaceships. This is a miniature spaceship. If it fails, they're going to lose their life and potentially. I mean, there were some backups, but still, it was touch and go failed. So
And final question to you, and there is so much to talk about during this hour. I'm curious about whether the astronauts, especially Armstrong and Aldrin, whether they felt like they had a personal relationship with the suits that they wore on Apollo 11, because it was such a risk. It did protect them, and it was sort of a second skin for them.
Yes, absolutely. They had spent a lot of time in the suits practicing, training. They would come up to Dover. They'd fly into Dover Air Base, and we'd pick them up and take them over to the plant, and they would do a fit check. And they got to be very comfortable in the suit. When the mission was over, I know we had Neil Armstrong wrote a little note saying he felt that the suit was cuddly to him. He loved the suit. It worked. And as a little side note, a couple of years ago, I ran into one of the Apollo astronauts, and he told me on his mission, he said he made the comment of how you could see on various missions they would fall down on the lunar surface, and it was Charlie Duke who told me the story, and he said, you could see me falling down on the surface, and he said, I had no care or worry about that suit. He said, we had complete confidence in it. He said, I was more worried about the backpack because it was a fiberglass shell. If I had landed on that, I'd be in trouble. But he said, I had no concern about the suit failing because we had tested it and been in it so much, he felt like it was a second skin to him.
Well, Bill Airy, William Airy, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's working on a book titled Lunar Outfitters. And again, Derek Pitt staying with us for the rest of the hour, remembering what it took to get Apollo 11 to the moon and back. And of course, that was 50 years ago tomorrow. We're celebrating today. And you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a couple of comments, and then we have another clip from my interview with Buzz Aldrin 20 years ago when he was talking to some school children here in Philadelphia. First, an email from PJ. PJ says, I was visiting my aunt and uncle during the summer of 1969. No one else wanted to waste a perfectly good summer's day inside watching what many were skeptical would be a successful moon landing, but my uncle convinced me that we would be watching history. I was 16 and forever grateful he convinced me to watch. It was nighttime, but nonetheless, a summer evening. An email from David. He says, 1969 was the one summer I went to camp. There was an old barn at the camp, and he talked about just Now, as an older person, he says, I still have my small model of the Apollo 11 nose cone with a removable lunar model. Every time I come across it, it reminds me of being sprawled on the floor of the barn at Camp Rose Twig with all the other summer campers watching that unbelievable event on a grainy image that nonetheless felt left a very vivid impression and the lasting feeling of the power of science to achieve the seemingly impossible. You're nodding your head, Derek.
Absolutely, sure. This was something that resonated with people all around the world. It didn't matter that this was an American task and accomplishment. People around the world felt as if the astronauts were extensions of them, as if they were out on the mission with them. And so that's why everybody around the world held their breath, collectively held their breath as this happened. You know, remembering of what happened that day, if you, you know, the person who mentioned that they wouldn't want to be inside on a summer afternoon, the spacecraft landed on the moon at 3:30 in the afternoon, and they remained inside the lunar module until 10:30 that evening. That's why it was, that's why people remember that it was dark when this took place. It was dark when they actually, it was dark here on the East Coast when they stepped out on the surface, but it was much, much earlier in the afternoon when they landed.
And I, too, remember that grainy black and white TV, not as big as the one you had, Derek, to look at.
We were styling back then.
Gathered with some friends. Well, let me play just, it's about almost 2 minutes, but it's Buzz Aldrin. He was a guest on Radio Times 20 years ago, as a matter of fact. And he's talking here with some students from Anne Frank Elementary School, asking him some questions about what it was like to be in space. Let's listen. Anyone else have a question from Anne Frank Elementary School?
Yes, Cameron has one about space sickness.
Okay. Hi, Cameron.
Did you get space sick, like what?
Yeah, like space. I had a question about
that's
that
too,
Cameron.
That's an excellent question, because we want to, in the future, take ordinary people into space, not just test pilots and people who've flown a lot of airplanes who don't get sick anymore. So we're going to want to do that. No, I didn't get sick. I've been a scuba diver, and I got used to moving around and seeing unusual situations underwater as a swimmer and a diver, and I think this helped some. I think we need to understand why people get sick a little better than we do right now. But most people aren't bothered after 2 or 3 days.
You kind of get used to it.
You get used to it.
Great, Cameron. That's a good question. Anyone else?
Okay. They just, a few of them had the same question, okay. And their question was it scary on the moon?
Was it scary on the moon?
Well, I've heard that one before. It was different. You know, I don't want to use the word alien because someone's going to say, geez, you saw some green people up there. No, we didn't. No, it was surreal. It was out of the ordinary, but it was pretty much as we expected. The scenery was spectacular, the clear sky, the horizon curving away. And I said, after being there a few moments, I said, magnificent desolation.
Magnificent desolation. And again, listening to Buzz Aldrin 20 years ago, he was a guest on Radio Times talking with students from Anne Frank Elementary School, answering some of their really basic questions. And do we still feel, Derek, that same kind of child, I don't mean childish in a childish way, but that sort of childhood enthusiasm for space?
When I talk to children, they do have that enthusiasm for space. You know, kids around the age of around 6 to 8 years old are just beginning to understand the three-dimensional nature of the sky and the fact that there are other objects out there and that you could possibly travel to them. And so there is this excitement about that. And the real question is, what do we do to maintain that level of curiosity and interest and excitement in exploring, you know, the rest of the environment we have around us in kids? And so I think it's really important for us to continue to look at the work that was done by Apollo, look at what the space program has done since then. I mean, we've had a space station in orbit now, functioning for a really long time, doing incredible work with international teams visiting space. And the future ahead is a bright one and presents a challenge for the next generation, like it presented a challenge for the past generation.
But we are seeing, you know, the commercial, maybe we've always had this, the kind of commercialization of space exploration, Virgin Galactic, Blue Origin. Blue Origin,
sure.
SpaceX. We've
yes.
got tourism
on the horizon, about to come across the horizon,
right.
Sure.
How does that change, or does it change what we do?
It's done a tremendous amount to open space access to low Earth orbit in ways that simply were not possible before. What we call these commercial entities, NASA has always worked with outside agencies, outside companies, corporations, as contractors to build all the parts and pieces for all of the missions. And now we have entities, entire companies that on their own develop their own launch capability and are in place to provide services to take anything to orbit. SpaceX is a great example of this. SpaceX has contracts with NASA to deliver supplies to International Space Station and astronauts to International Space Station in the next year or so. And so these kinds of changes help to facilitate our access to space in a really interesting way, because if you think about it, the kind of work that NASA does, NASA's really built and set up to do the really big tasks, like the major discoveries and exploring the deep solar system. But companies like SpaceX or Blue Origin can take over some of the other work of delivering supplies to space station or taking astronauts back and forth to space station. And that really helps, because the technologies that they develop can help the NASA program, the work that NASA does helps these other programs, and it just expands our capability to access space and gives us ways to open the doors for others to get there.
Candida asking, can you talk about helium-3 mining on the moon? Is this a viable resource for us in the future? And even beyond that, should we think of the moon as a kind of resource for Earth?
That's a really interesting question, because it has been at least 25 years since I first read a book that talked about using the resources of space as a way to reduce the cost of exploration in the deep solar system work. And as you heard, I think it was Jake that said, it costs money to take stuff into space. You know, water is 8 pounds a gallon. That's pretty heavy, actually, and each pound costs about $10,000. So imagine you want to take a bunch of equipment up to space that you're going to use to assemble a spacecraft to take you someplace else. It gets very expensive to lift all of that mass out of Earth orbit. Well, if we can develop the technology to use resources on the moon, like helium-3 and the hydrogen and the oxygen and other materials that are there, if we can use that to create the materials we need to build the spacecraft to go into deep space, it reduces the cost dramatically, because the moon's gravity is only 1/6 that of Earth. So the cost to get off of the planet, off of the moon, is way lower.
That is Derek Pitts, a very familiar voice here at WHYY, Chief Astronomer, Planetarium Director at the Franklin Institute. We are marking the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission to the moon and, of course, the lunar landing, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walking on the moon. We'll also be talking about 1969, a year of tumult, and Woodstock. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. The surface is fine and powdery. I can kick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sole and sides of my boot.
That, of course, is astronaut Neil Armstrong saying his now famous words about walking on the moon in July 1969. 1 month later, in August of that year, 500,000 people attended Woodstock, maybe the cultural and political opposite of the moon landing that was supported by the government, the military-industrial space complex. Our guest, Neil Marr, captures the deep divisions in the country at that time in his book, Apollo in the Age of Aquarius. He's a professor of history at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and Rutgers University, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times this week, Not Everyone Wanted a Man on the Moon, about the civil rights, anti-war, and environmental activists who opposed the moon mission or were not inspired by it. And Neil Marr, joining us from Europe somewhere by Skype, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be with you, Marty. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And Derek Pitt staying with us for the rest of the hour. So we want to shift gears here. And we've been obviously focusing on the moon landing for all the obvious reasons. But it is, I think, important and instructive, Neil, to think about what happened in August, Woodstock, of course, and yep. how that sort of represent those sort of the poles of that summer. Can you speak to that?
Sure. I think that it's important to remember that whereas a million people flocked down to Cape Canaveral to celebrate the Apollo 11 launch, a mere month later, 3 weeks later, 500,000 young people went up to Woodstock to dance in the mud to a lot of songs that were quite critical of the country. And I think that that summer of Apollo and Woodstock really represents, in some ways, a cultural divide or division. You know, should America be the sort of country that spends $20 billion putting a man on the moon? Or should the country instead use the economic and political capital instead to try to solve or deal with some of the more pressing problems at home?
That was
a question playing out, I think, during that summer.
Absolutely. I mean, this was the heart of the Vietnam War. And the country was really, in many ways, Derek, and to you, Neil, tearing itself apart because of the war.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that I'm not trying to say here that there weren't people who were, you know, against the war who were people who were against the war who were also very
sure.
in favor of space flight and space exploration and Apollo. But in general, I think there was this division. There were people out there who thought that this money might be better spent.
Derek, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to say that there. If you really think about how things were in the United States at that time, of course there were many people who were against the idea of spending this kind of money to go to the moon when there were so many social problems here that we were trying to confront at the same time. It was the year before that Dr. Martin Luther King had been assassinated and Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated. And the sort of stage set of the civil rights movement and these social issues really were much more important to people for whom these issues were really front and center in their lives. The exploration of the moon is incredibly remote because many people are dealing with issues of just basic survival. So it's very,
Absolutely.
Very hard to sort of yeah. grab hold of this concept of spending $25 billion to go to the moon where there are these immediate issues.
Yeah, in fact, Neil, you describe Reverend Ralph Abernathy, head of the SCLC, protested at Cape Kennedy while all this was going on.
Yeah, it's sort of an amazing moment. It's the day before the Apollo launch. The Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who took over as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference after Martin Luther King was assassinated the year before, he marches to the western gate of the Kennedy Space Center the day before the Apollo launch with 25 poor African-American families, two rickety wagons being pulled by four mules, and he meets with NASA's head, Thomas Paine. And he says to Paine very carefully, he says, "We are not here to protest the Apollo mission." And in the background of the big field where they were meeting, you could see the rocket in the distance. Abernathy says, "We're here to protest the nation's distorted sense of national priorities,"
wow.
where one-fifth of the country is ill-housed, has not enough food and not enough clothing. So it was a very incredible moment that combined civil rights issues with the space race.
Neil, he was invited inside, though, to witness the launch. Do we
yeah.
have that? Do I have that right? Just
Absolutely.
To finish the story here.
Yeah, Thomas Paine says, "If I could not push that button and not launch tomorrow and make sure all that money went to your problems, I would do that. But instead, why don't you hitch your wagons to our rockets and join us?" And then he handed Ralph Abernathy a number of VIP passes to the launch. And Abernathy, being, you know, the incredibly savvy civil rights leader that he was, he goes to the launch and basically talks to the audience and gets them to sing We Shall Overcome Together, and really discusses many of the problems facing his people prior to the launch. So it was a great moment for Abernathy, and it raised a lot of the issues that he was, you know, concerned about to a much, much broader public.
I mean, that is as inspiring as JFK's speech in 1962. As a kind of book, interesting bookends, Derek?
Yeah, I think it's it shows that the Apollo program was a unifier in many different ways. But at the same time, if you think about the words that Kennedy said, you know, we choose to do these things not because they're easy, but because they're hard. And we want to be able to do these and all of those other hard things as well. I mean, there's a perfect opportunity for Abernathy to take advantage of that, yeah, indicating that solving these social ills is as hard a thing as going to the moon. But if we have the will to do that, of sending people to the moon, we should also have the will to solve these social issues as well.
Let me read an email from Peter. He says, while the moon landing is a remarkable feat of humanity, I was wondering if your guests could speak to the criticisms of the amount of money that was spent on the space race and the money, time, energy, and resources currently being used to explore other worlds when we are in an environmental crisis on Earth. So in many ways, Neil Marr, we're kind of where we were 50 years ago, still trying to figure out where to, I guess, what is the best return on the kind of investment that we make, either right, in social programs or in space exploration?
One of the real positive stories is the story of NASA's relationship with the very early environmental movement. And this speaks very much to our climate crisis today. So early on, environmentalists were quite critical of NASA, number one, for polluting Cape Canaveral with its launches, but also for taking the nation's sort of eye off the pollution problem, the mounting pollution problem in the country. And in the early 60s, NASA administrators can basically ignore many of these critiques because so many people are supportive of beating the Russians to the moon. But in the 70s, its budget begins to dwindle, and NASA has to figure out ways to engage these movements. And it does this by launching satellites that later become Landsat, that basically collect global ecological data that many scientists, you know, environmental scientists, use over the next 20 years to track ecological changes and ultimately lead to the confirmation of the climate change crisis. So NASA right now is at the forefront of providing us data to track climate change. So this is a real success story when it comes to environmentalism.
And Derek, you've been a guest on Radio Times before where we've talked about with our listeners about where's the best investment and what is the return that we've gotten on our investment in space.
Sure, right. On that particular vein of using the satellites to explore our planet, you know, it's been said that a lot of the tools that NASA has used to explore all the other planets of the solar system have been brought to bear on our planet in a way that's helped us to clearly understand what the situation is with our environment. But, though, you know, when we talk about the return of the missions of space exploration, so much of that technology has slowly seeped into our current style of living. We can't fairly say that the Apollo program invented computers. So many technologies had been in place before, but further developed. But all of those technologies that have gone into the space program have come into our lives and improved the quality of life in so many ways, and continues to do so as those technologies then trickle down to us. And that's a great boon and benefit of that. If we look at how we're spending those dollars, I'm not sure what it is this year, but a couple of years ago when I was looking really closely at this, NASA was 14th in the top 20 line items of the U.S. budget at something like $17 billion at that time, just a couple of years ago, up now a few more billion dollars, but still fairly far down when you look at how the U.S. spends its dollars. And so in some ways, if you look at it in one way, it's said that, you know, NASA's budget is equal to sort of like one penny of every tax dollar that comes from American citizens. And so that doesn't seem like it's a lot. In a lump sum, it's a lot of money. But if we look at where the rest of the money is distributed around the budget, there's plenty of money that could be used to do all the other things that need to happen.
Let me read a couple of more emails. One from Ed. He says, I was just shy of turning 14 in 1969, watching CBS and waiting for the hatch to open. I vividly remember walking out in our front yard and looking up. The moon was out, though I don't recall what phase it was in, and I stood there in the grass, staring for much longer than normal, and tried to imagine the gravity of one machine and two men way out there on the moon's surface, still amazed. An email from Tina, she says, I was just entering ninth grade, and we were visiting my dad's family in southern Italy for the summer. My memory is that my Italian relatives and people of the village congratulating us on reaching the moon. Most of my relatives and the village folk in this southern Italian town were communists, but they were so respectful, and it felt it was important to congratulate us. Neil, any thoughts about that?
I do think that it was a moment that really brought the world together in a way that was unique and perhaps we haven't seen since. But I do think it's important to remember, you know, some of the other voices that were not so much critical of the mission, but just wanted to remind us of what was going on back on Earth. I think that what happens is when those voices are raised again, or when we're reminded of those voices, sometimes people see that as a criticism of Apollo or a criticism of NASA, and that's not really what it was. People could both be very proud about NASA and the country, but also just think that maybe we need to also think about some other problems going on. So I think it's a really good point that caller just made.
But you also make in the piece that you had in the New York Times is that these activists, you mentioned the environmentalists, but the anti-war activists and some of the other gender activists, the women's rights movement activists, that they had a profound impact on NASA. Sort of from the ground up, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that what these street activists really did was they put some pressure on NASA to guide it and make it shift gears a little bit. And I think that while privatization of space exploration today is a wonderful move on the economic level, it is incredibly efficient. I believe the Falcon X rocket costs one-tenth what the Saturn V costs to get the three astronauts to the moon. So economically, it's an absolute success. I do think, though, we have to remember the political, not dangers, but the political pitfalls of this privatization process, because when we put all our eggs in that privatization basket, and we haven't done that yet, we remove space exploration from our civic culture. We take it off the soapbox of our collective town square, and then we have less of a voice in guiding and shaping space exploration. So I think we just need to balance the two, keep a robust funded federal program, as well as explore and continue to think about privatization and do that together.
Do you want to add to that, Derek?
Yeah, I would argue that indeed it is really positive to have the privatization piece in that, because the private companies in some regards have much greater latitude for what they can do than NASA does. And it's not that they have greater technological capability than NASA. That's not the point. The point is that NASA's money comes through Congress, and Congress is responsible for deciding how much money NASA gets. Mm-hmm. And so NASA is in some ways hobbled by Congress's will to want to do these things, whereas the private companies can, within safety parameters, almost do whatever kind of exploration they want. So that the shift that I see that I think is incredibly important is that to keep in mind that NASA, as the national agency, has this really great capability to do deep space exploration, the grand works of exploring the solar system, while the private companies can do a tremendous amount to not only support what NASA does, but to press the envelope in other ways as well.
Neil, we're almost out of time, but I can't help but think about 1969, 50 years ago, and just, again, how tumultuous things were. We should also say that I believe Chappaquiddick was 50 years ago today, just to sort of add to the drama of our discussion here. But thinking about just how tumultuous things feel today compared to 1969, and, you know, we're still here, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are equally divided. It almost makes the 1969 summer seem tame by comparison.
Yeah.
But I also think that we've made a lot of great strides. I mean, you know, there's nothing like the Vietnam War going on right now. I think that on the racial and gender front, we're a much more open society and a much more thoughtful society. So I think in a lot of ways, we can learn from that period, and that period helped us think and process those things. But we also have a long way to go. There's a lot of political infighting going on today that makes it very, very difficult. And maybe if we explore space in a similar way as we did in the 1960s, we can begin a dialogue, not only about space exploration, but also about what we want the planet to be and what we want the country to be.
A perfect place to end our conversation. Neil Marr, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times by Skype from Europe.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Professor of History at the New Jersey Institute of Technology and at Rutgers University, their Newark campus, author of a book called Apollo in the Age of Aquarius. Derek Pitts, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on
Thanks
Radio
for having
Times
me.
As well. Chief astronomer and planetarium director at the Franklin Institute. And this is Walking on the Moon by the Police.